Let's move along to the next case on the docket for today, which is Dwayne Stone v. United States of America, case 20-1778. Let's see. For the appellant, we have Mr. Habib.
Good afternoon, Your Honor.
Good afternoon, and I understand you would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. Is that right?
That is. Thank you.
Thank you. You may proceed.
May it please the Court, Daniel Habib, Federal Defenders of New York, on behalf of Dwayne Stone. The District Court erred in denying Stone's Section 2255 motion to vacate his Count 13 conviction and 300-month sentence for using a firearm in connection with a crime of violence. It's undisputed that the trial judge in this case committed constitutional error by instructing the jury that it could predicate the Count 13 conviction on a conspiracy to commit murder in aid of racketeering. In United States v. Hayward, this Court held that conspiracy to commit murder in aid of racketeering is not a Section 924C crime of violence in light of Davis. And in United States v. Eldridge, this Court reiterated that constitutional error occurs where, as here, quote, disjunctive theories of culpability are submitted to a jury that returns a general verdict of guilty, and one or more of the theories was legally insufficient. So the constitutional error established the question in this case is harmlessness, specifically whether the government has carried its burden on collateral review of establishing that the error is harmless. The government has two arguments on that score, and neither is persuasive. First, the government contends that the conjunctively alleged count required the jury, in fact, to find the use of a firearm in connection with both threats.
Can we skip over that, if you don't mind?
Sure.
I'd very much like you, if you could, turn to Eldridge.
Yes.
And how Eldridge held, and I appreciate it was decided after both sides had briefed their cases, but you've submitted some letters on it. Why does that not govern here? We explained in Eldridge how a Yates error is evaluated for harmlessness. I understand you've got a different argument that was not raised in Eldridge, which is you think that Shepard constrains the way we engage in harmless error. So is your view that Eldridge was wrongly decided, and you can't blame anyone because people didn't make the right argument, or are you arguing that Eldridge, may or may not have been rightly decided, but this case is somehow different from Eldridge? Maybe could you start with that?
I could. Let me try to unpack your own.
Please.
I think my principal submission would be, because the parties in Eldridge didn't address the methodological question of what the appropriate set of documents is in reviewing a data error of harmlessness, Eldridge can't be regarded as binding this panel in a precedential manner on that question. And I'm happy to discuss at great length why I think our proposed approach is correct. But as a simple matter, can this court reach the results Stone is advocating, notwithstanding Eldridge? The answer is yes.
So because we didn't talk about the Shepard argument that you're raising now, you would argue that that's an open question.
And so I would point to this court's decision in Villanueva versus United States, cited in last week's 28J letter, which is merely one of the long line of cases in which this court has said issues that are present in the background of the case but not brought to the court's attention can't be regarded as having resolved those issues sub silentio.
So, assuming that we're correct, explain to us why you think Shepard governs here and why your argument isn't foreclosed by cases like Nader and Johnson, where the Supreme Court has said, look, you may have an underlying Sixth Amendment issue. You misinstructed a jury on an element, or maybe you completely omitted an element. So you've got a Sixth Amendment violation in spades. But we're going to engage in harmlessness analysis or plain error analysis that does look at, for example, the weight of the evidence. Why isn't that, maybe not flow from Eldridge, but why doesn't that answer flow from Nader and Johnson? Because I think your argument here is that you have a Sixth Amendment issue. You misinstructed the jury on some of the predicates. Why aren't we within that large category, a subspecies of a Nader and Johnson situation?
So I would say this, Your Honor. The question that's presented when a jury has returned a general verdict of guilty on a 924C count has been instructed on both valid and invalid predicates. The question for purposes of harmlessness analysis is, can we tell what the jury did? And if the jury, in fact, relied on an invalid predicate, has the defendant suffered prejudice?
Well, wait, is that really the question? I didn't think that's the question of Yates. I thought Yates didn't say we can tell what the jury relied upon. We're saying even if they relied upon something wrong, would their verdict nevertheless have been the same? That's different from Griffin when you're dealing with the evidence and you're saying there's two factual issues. We're going to presume that the jury relied on the factual premise that was in fact supported by sufficiency of the evidence. But when we're in Yates, we don't ask the question of did they think something wrong, but even if they did think something wrong, do we think that they, you know, within a requisite level of certainty, would they have reached the same answer? I mean, isn't that what Yates told us?
I understand the distinction, Your Honor, but I would put it this way. We're asking on collateral review whether the error has substantial injurious effect on the verdict. And if I can say as a matter of historical fact, jury relied on an invalid predicate to return conviction. But it's difficult to say that the error didn't.
Well, then how do you know, though? I thought the whole point is there's a valid predicate, there's an invalid predicate. So how is it that you're now asserting to us that we know as a matter of historical fact they were lying on the other one? Because they didn't check it off in the box. So
that's
we're left in a state of uncertainty, and then aren't we supposed to then look at the strength of the evidence?
So that's, in fact, my precise point, Your Honor, is that because we're in a state of uncertainty, O'Neill tells us how to resolve uncertainty in a case like this. Because we cannot say with the requisite level of confidence by examining materials like the indictment, like the jury instructions, like the verdict, which, by the way—
But why not the evidence?
So I would say that in this particular context, in the context of assessing the validity of 924C convictions, the Supreme Court and this Court prior to Eldridge have consistently said that the appropriate analysis is categorical.
But that's to determine whether the predicate is a predicate, not whether someone, the jury, actually relied on the predicate. Those are two different questions. And the Shepherd analysis, I thought, was grounded in the Sixth Amendment, saying you've got to stick to Shepherd documents, otherwise you're going to violate the Sixth Amendment. Here we're saying, yeah, there's a Sixth Amendment instructional problem. We got that. Now we're beyond it, and we're asking about harmlessness.
No, I think, let me say a few things. So one, I think we are saying, to be precise about the constitutional claim, our claim is that there's a Fifth Amendment error in the jury instruction which submitted a vague threat. I would say, second, that the concerns that animate the categorical approach are not strictly Sixth Amendment concerns. The Supreme Court has said, in cases such as Taylor and Descamp and Mathis, that the set of concerns driving the application of the categorical approach include practical as well as equitable considerations. And so, for example, it will often be very difficult as a practical matter to answer the question either in the way that I'm framing it, what did the jury do, or in the way that Your Honor is framing it, what can we say that the jury would have done? In addition, as to equity, it would be profoundly inequitable to make a 300-month sentence term today on a question that the defense had no incentive to confess at the time of trial, and had it been on notice that this question would matter.
Well, that's how harmlessness often works, isn't it? We wouldn't necessarily have the ability to contest it when we find an error on appeal.
And what I'm suggesting in answer to Judge Nardini's question is that it's not just the Sixth Amendment problem, which I take your point, right? That under neither, you know, the omission of an element can be harmless, notwithstanding the absence of a jury finding. I understand that point. But what I'm suggesting is I'm trying to broaden the set of justifications for application of
Can I ask just how much uncertainty we have here exactly? I mean, the allegations of conspiracy to murder and then murder are that he got a gun from the co-conspirator and went and shot the person in the face. How is it plausible that the jury decided that he possessed a gun as part of the conspiracy but not as part of the murder? Aren't they all just intertwined?
So a number of responses, but let me just sort of make a threshold. If the court disagrees with our methodological premise, 2016 inquiry. I respectfully submit that the appropriate disposition here would be to remand.
Wait, sorry. When you say the categorical approach governs the harmlessness inquiry, you're saying basically we should decide what a jury in the abstract might have done acting on these instructions? Is that?
No. To be precise, what I'm suggesting is that in analyzing whether the question is framed as what did this jury do or what would the jury have done given a proper instruction, the set of materials that this court should consult in answering those questions is limited to the Shepherd materials.
But aren't we trying to determine what this particular jury did in this particular case?
I would submit that we cannot know with a requisite degree of certainty what this particular jury did in this case.
Well, all right, so why don't you just answer the question that I had posed. So how is it plausible that the jury could have possibly concluded he had a gun as part of the conspiracy to murder, but not as part of the murder, which they decided that he had committed?
So let me two responses to that, Governor Nashi. First, the court's question assumes not unreasonably that the jury would apply factual findings made with respect to one count to another count. But we know that, in fact, this jury didn't do so. If I could unpack that briefly. With respect to Mr. Stone's co-defendant, James McTeer, the jury convicted him on count 10 for a substantive murder in aid of racketeering of an individual named Ricky Tubes. However, the jury also found not proved racketeering act 6, count 1, which was based on the exact same facts. So it's not certain that the jury's conviction on count 12 necessarily implies, and that's the legal standard I think articulated even in Eldridge, necessarily.
Did we say that it necessarily implies, or did we? My recollection.
You know.
I might not know. I might be the least reliable person here on Eldridge. But my recollection is that we stated the threshold of certainty necessary, but then we went on to say effectively that that threshold had been exceedingly well surpassed because the evidence, which I recall, was actually quite analogous to the evidence here, which is that the defendant just went up and shot a guy. And whether you called it attempted murder, conspiracy to murder, or murder, the entire and sole theory was that he walked up, pointed a gun at somebody, he pulled up and launched the bullet, which I thought was quite analogous to here. So I'm just kind of interested in I understand your theory that, well, maybe there's some other count as to some other defendant which suggests this was a jury that was prone to inconsistency, and therefore we should not presume consistency here. But if you're just trying to distinguish, say, Eldridge from Hayward, where the court came out with different results based on the particulars of the kind of murder and the kind of charges here, why isn't this squarely in Eldridge land and not in Hayward land?
So two responses, Your Honor. First, in Eldridge, this court pointed to not only the strength of the evidence supporting the valid attempted Hobbs Act robbery predicate, but also the link between the jury's finding that the firearm had been brandished and the valid predicate. That is to say, the evidence was that the defendant pointed the gun at the robbery victim. Here, the 924C count was charged, and this is prior to the lead, so the jury wasn't asked to make a finding of use, carry, possess, brandish, discharge. The jury was simply charged on use, carry, possess. And so there's nothing that would have prevented the jury from relying on a carry theory.
But was there any evidence presented to the jury, any argument made by the government to support your theory that said, jury, you may not think that he shot this man, but he was probably carrying a gun in connection with the murder. Was there anything like that presented?
No, Your Honor. The trial defense was that Mr. Stone was innocent.
So I guess that's what we're struggling with, right? Like, how do we get into this this alternative universe that nobody ever talked about when we're trying to figure out what happened or would have happened at the trial with the evidence and the arguments that were made?
The most that I can say is that the counts of murder conspiracy was charged in the indictment on both direct and aiding and abetting theories of liability. The district court, in fairness, referred to both of those sections of the New York penal law in summarizing the indictment to the jury. And so there is a universe where it's conceivable that the jury believed A, Mr. Stone and the cooperating witness, Romel Baker, formed an agreement to murder Jamel Washington. That B, Mr. Stone carried the firearm from the place where the meeting occurred to the place where the murder occurred. But that C, accepted the defense's suggestion that the actual shooter was Romel Baker. And so again, without contesting the proposition that a conviction secured pursuant to an aiding and abetting theory of liability can suffice to support 924C liability, it's a conceptual path where the jury can say...
It's a conceptual path, but it doesn't seem plausible in this case, does it?
And so with respect, because it's conceptually available, and Eldred spoke of...
So you're saying we should decide whenever it's conceptually available?
No, Your Honor. I'm not asking for to win on that ground for this court. I'm saying that if this court, A, determines that Eldred supplies the appropriate framework for harmlessness analysis, and rejects our argument to the contrary, that the appropriate disposition would be to remand to allow the district court to conduct a prejudice analysis in the first instance, which wasn't done.
Well, can I ask even about Hayward? So in Hayward itself, we distinguished this prior summary order, Vasquez, which had a similar issue, and it said, we concluded that because the robbery scheme was presented as part of the proved narcotics scheme and because the defendant points to nothing in the record showing that the two schemes were separable, the firearms conviction on a valid 924C the firearms conviction rested on a valid 924C drug trafficking predicate. And the court says that the Vasquez principle is sound in general. So here, isn't it all one inseparable scheme? He gets the gun and then shoots the guy in the face? I mean, it's not presented as two different things. I mean, you're saying it's conceptually possible they could have distinguished it, but that doesn't seem like that's a plausible way that the jury would have behaved.
So my understanding of Vasquez, Your Honor, is that when this court used the phrase inextricably intertwined and then picked up on the phrase of Eldridge, that's got to be understood in light of the specific theory of liability and finding of liability in Vasquez, which was a Pinkerton conviction on a 924C count where the conspiracy of which the defendant was found to have been a member was a conspiracy to rob drug dealers. So the defendant could not have been convicted if the jury did not agree both that he conspired to rob and that he conspired to rob drugs, such that there would always be a valid drug trafficking.
Such that both of them are necessarily drug predicates.
Correct.
But then we wouldn't have to say that they were inextricably intertwined. We would just have to say that they were both drug predicates, right?
No, what I mean is that the analytical path that Vasquez takes is, if the jury relied on what you said is an invalid predicate of that conspiracy to rob what? Drugs. So that if the jury relied on the invalid predicate, there's no harm because the agreement was an agreement to rob drugs. And consequently, had the jury gone down that impermissible path...
Right, no, I understand. I guess just the way, what I'm reacting to is we could have described that then not as two alternatives that were inextricably intertwined. We could have said they could have been two predicates that each would have qualified. That would have been a more natural way to express the thought that you're describing.
Except that under the categorical approach, which again we're now applying just to determine whether or not these things are valid predicates, not what the jury did, but under that approach, a Hobbs Act conspiracy would have to be evaluated as such. The nature of the property to be taken wouldn't factor into the categorical analysis.
Can I ask about the earlier point you made about how the jury seemed to have these inconsistent decisions? If they didn't, could we then infer what made logical sense? Is that key to this argument?
I think it assists the harmlessness argument. So if we're now in the zone where the court is considering the full record, I think one thing, right, if it is going to be a fact-sensitive, fact-immersed analysis of harmlessness, I would say a number of things. I would make this jury inconsistency point. I would make this aiding and abetting point. And there may be more. This is a four-week trial. The transcript is 5,000 pages long. There are 22 counts of multiple co-defendants. And that's why it's in the nature of the analysis I'm suggesting should be conducted by a district court with the benefit of the full record.
Why would that be necessary if the evidence was overwhelming? If we're going on the evidence-based approach, you simply pose the question, what would the jury have done had the charge been proper? That's what we do usually when there's an erroneous charge of whatever nature. and or there's an error in the charge. And then you assume it to be a proper So here it would be whatever it is, count 11, I guess, the actual murder. Suppose they were just charged that that was a predicate act, and that was it. Was there sufficient evidence, not sufficient evidence, such evidence that you can't say that that the failure was harmful?
And what I'm suggesting, again, we're considering the full scope of the evidence, is that for at least two reasons. One, the inconsistency as reflected with respect to the co-defendant, and two, the possibility of aiding and abetting liability, which supplies a conceptual path to a finding that the firearm was possessed only in connection with conspiracy, that this court today, on this present record, can't have the requisite level.
Well, sir, you have reserved 2 minutes for rebuttal. Is that right? Thank you very much. We've kept you over your time. Mr. Axelrod?
Good afternoon. May it please the Court, Nick Axelrod on behalf of the United States. Judge Herdy, I'll borrow from you. We are squarely in Eldridge land, Your Honor.
Well, and then I'm going to ask you, since you're going to go there, it's true, isn't it, that the Shepherd argument was not raised in Eldridge, right?
I agree that it was not raised in Eldridge.
So would you agree then that you know, the Shepherd argument is not necessarily foreclosed as a matter of law by Eldridge because it simply wasn't raised and we didn't express any view on that?
I think it's foreclosed by the Brecht and Hedge test, Your Honor. And I think it's not surprising that it wasn't raised in Eldridge because Supreme Court precedent says that's not how you conduct harmlessness analysis.
Yeah, this is a, in other words, your view is that this is a routine harmless error case where an error has been made in the charge, and the question is, what would the outcome have been had the evidence, had the charge been proper based on the evidence?
That's correct, Judge Long. As I was saying, the Court's recent opinion in the United States against Eldridge does resolve this case. Eldridge sets out the applicable analysis, and it dictates the Court's conclusion, whereas here, a 924C count is based on both a valid and an invalid predicate that arise out of a single incident, a single continuous course of conduct. Under Eldridge, the error is harmless. To the petitioner's argument that harmlessness analysis is limited to Shepherd documents, that's inconsistent with the methodology employed in Eldridge. I concede that this question wasn't presented in Eldridge, but it's inconsistent with the methodology employed. It's foreclosed by the Supreme Court's decision in Hedgepeth, which, by the way, cited the decision in Nader and applied Nader to a Yates error, and which the Court cited in Eldridge.
And the harmless error analysis that pre-existed Mattis and the various categorical approach cases has not been invalidated by the Supreme Court.
Harmlessness analysis has not been.
In terms of harmless analysis, right? I mean, it's the same old harmless analysis that goes back to Brecht.
Yes, it's the same harmlessness analysis that goes back before Brecht to Kodiakos,
exactly.
Which is the standard borrowed in Brecht. And since Chapman, constitutional error of this nature has been subject to harmlessness analysis.
Yeah, and on that point, and maybe this doesn't turn on it, but correct me if I'm wrong, Eldridge was a direct appeal case, right?
Eldridge was a direct appeal case.
And it was on plain error?
That's correct, Your Honor, and that could conceivably in some cases make a difference because the standard, and I would just note, Your Honor, as far as I can tell, Eldridge does not cite Vasquez. What Eldridge does...
Well, Vasquez was a summary order, right?
That's correct, but the standard under Eldridge is, I believe, slightly different. If Eldridge, in note 16... Your Honor describes the reasonable probability or the reasonable doubt standard that is applicable in the plain error context on direct review. Now, that standard is actually more difficult for the government to meet than the standard that governs this appeal on collateral review under direct and under Hedgepeth, which asks rather if there's a grave doubt, i.e., if the court is an equal focus as to whether the error is harmless, then the tie goes to the defendant.
And would your suggestion be that a defendant who doesn't preserve an issue and then raises it on collateral review, and for understandable reasons, all this case law is happening afterwards, but should certainly not be subjected to a more favorable or more forgiving standard of review on collateral review than they would get on plain error review when the case is still on direct appeal. In other words, it shouldn't get harder and then easier from preserved error to plain error and then easier again when you get to collateral review, right?
That's exactly right, Your Honor. I think Brecht is quite clear about the potential reasons why the standard is actually more difficult for the defendant on collateral review because there are particular interests in the finality of verdicts that apply on collateral review.
But does it get meaningfully different from the standard on plain error review?
Pardon me?
Does it get the standard for measuring prejudice? Does it differ in any meaningful way from the standard for assessing prejudice under plain error when we shift the burden of proving all four prongs of plain error, including prejudice? They're shifted all back to the defendant. How is it materially different then, the prejudice inquiry on plain error or in 2255?
I think there may be some cases, it is certainly not this case, where an error is not harmless on direct review under the plain error test because there is a reasonable possibility that the error affected the jury's judgment, but that nonetheless that error would be harmless on collateral review because there is not a grave doubt. That is certainly not this case. I don't think the court needs to grapple with the differences between those two standards. It's just not presented here because there is no doubt that here, where all the facts overlap, where there were two cooperators who testified to a very short conspiracy, a conspiracy that started moments before the murder, that took place within a 2 or 3 block area.
But what about opposing counsel's argument about aiding and abetting and how it's conceptually possible that they would have thought that he had the gun for the conspiracy and not as part of the murder?
So that's not how the case was argued to the jury. The defense counsel never suggested that somehow this defendant was a member of the conspiracy but not the shooter. It was straight up and down. Either you believed the cooperators and Mr. Stone was the shooter, or you didn't believe the cooperators at all and Mr. Stone was not there.
What about the argument about the inconsistent verdicts?
That's not this defendant. That's James McTyre. And I would note also that the elements of a RICO predicate and the murder and aid of are slightly different. I'm not sure, candidly, what the jury was doing with Mr. McTyre, but I know, as to Mr. Stone, is that the jury convicted Mr. Stone of the substantive murder. It convicted him of the conspiracy on all the same terms as the substantive murder, and it convicted him of the 924C count. If the panel has no further questions, I'll yield back my time.
Thank you very much. Mr. Habib, you've reserved some time.
Thank you. I want to make a few brief points. First, Judge Sardini, I don't think there's anything anomalous about the standard of review we're arguing here, notwithstanding that we're in a 2255 posture. In fact, in the ordinary case of an unreserved claim raised for the first time on 2255, the movement will be subject to a procedural default defense, which will subject him to a much more onerous standard than is true on plain error.
Now, you have to show cause and prejudice, right?
Correct. And so actual prejudice as well as cause.
And could you just clarify for me, my recollection is that that was something, was that not argued by the government here or conceded, or where are we in terms of cause and prejudice on this? I'm a little confused, honestly, about why that's not an issue before us.
Yeah, the answer is quite straightforward, Your Honor. The government didn't raise procedural default in the district court. And so under this court's decision in Kennedy, 126 F3rd at 359-60, defense is waived.
Right. So that's something that the government is free to assert. If they don't assert it, it's out the window and we don't consider it.
It's an affirmative defense, and that's all in the Kennedy. Judge Menasche, with respect to the aiding and abetting theory, I do want to be candid. I don't want to oversell this in the record. The indictment charged both direct and aiding and abetting theories of liability. The district court, the trial court, in its explanation of the indictment to the jury, referred to both of those sections of the penal law, but it didn't go further and provide a separate aiding and abetting instruction. So I don't want to oversell what the record shows. It's more in the way of demonstrating that there are questions about the record that could be explored and whose impact could be assessed by the trial.
But are there questions? I mean, if it was never argued at the trial, I mean, if we're just trying to explain what the jury did.
And the answer, it wasn't Judge Menasche, and the answer is because it wouldn't have mattered prior to Davis. Right? If the jury accepted that Mr. Stone carried the gun in connection with conspiracy, but not the substantive murder.
I understand that would not have mattered, but the question is it possible that when we're asking if it's possible the jury decided that he was guilty of the murder because of aiding and abetting, and so therefore conceivably had the gun as part of the conspiracy but not as part of the murder, if that's possible, you would think that there would be evidence before the jury suggesting that, but if in fact the whole argument of the case was that that's not what happened, that he in fact took the gun and shot him in the face himself, then when we're trying to determine what predicate the jury was relying on, why wouldn't we just say, well, obviously the jury thought he had the gun and shot him and shot the victim?
So it's true that the defense's principal argument was that the cooperator shouldn't be believed and that Mr. Stone wasn't a participant in the murders. However, the defense also suggested that Romel Baker, the principal cooperator's motive to lie, could have stemmed from the fact that he was the shooter. So the jury kind of come out halfway. The jury kind of said, we believe you were a part of the plan, but we also agree that Romel Baker had a reason to lie and implicate you as the shooter rather than himself.
And so then the jury would have convicted him of the murder based on an aiding and abetting theory that the government didn't even argue?
So, again,
but that wasn't the defense, was it?
No, Your Honor, the defense was that Mr. Stone wasn't.
I mean, don't we take a realistic look at what happened at the trial and how it was argued and presented to the jury?
And what I'm suggesting is that if we're taking seriously, if we're applying the set of precedents that hold that a court requires certainty, conducting this form of analysis, if we apply the statements in Eldridge to the effect that that conviction was affirmed because the jury verdict would have been inconceivable, in the context of both the inconsistent verdict and the possibility, which again, granted, wasn't an argument that was presented to the jury, but was not unavailable to the jury given the language of the charging instrument.
Okay, so let's think about that. So if there's a theory that is conceivable, but we just look at the evidence and like there's no way the jury really was thinking that, what do we do with that?
If we're in the sort of doctrinal space where we're now looking at the full record, which again I'm suggesting is something that this court should defer to the district court, but if we're in that space, the government is absolutely free to argue that there's no way the jury could have done what you suggest because we never asked them to. And it would be our place to say, well, in fact, it was an available path to the jury, and a jury that had doubts about who the actual shooter was, Mr. Stone, or, as suggested by the defense for Bell Baker, could have come to this conclusion. In particular, in a case where the jury is doing other things that don't present as logical or consistent to a panel of appellate judges, that question can be addressed by Judge Glasser, by the way, presided at the trial in the first instance, and there would be nothing inappropriate about that disposition.
And what kind of an inquiry is he conducting that we can't do looking at the record?
The only thing that he would do is that he would have the benefit of the entire trial record, and he would have the benefit of the party's focused arguments on the harmlessness question in light of the supervening guidance provided by Eldridge and Baker, which wasn't available. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much to both of you. Very well argued. We will reserve decision. I'll also